Welcome back. Last time, I talked about some issues concerning the ways that ancient states controlled, thought about the territories and borders that surrounded the capitals. One of the things I noted was that in comparison to modern state-level societies, these ancient states often had relatively limited capacity to project power at a distance, and that we should not be fooled by images of modern state-level societies when we think of ancient states, for example, in Mesopotamia or the Nile Valley or in other parts of the world, that these ancient states in many cases did not control territory in the way that modern states do, and that they also were in contact with a whole variety of other kinds of political and economic systems around their frontiers, around their borders, that, again, changed the dynamic, changed the relationship between the state center, the larger population of the state, and the territory more or less under its control. More broadly, comparisons of state formation in Mesopotamia and the Nile Valley have proven very fruitful, very useful for archaeologists seeking to understand these processes in prehistory. However, there's always a danger here that we'll take these cases from Mesopotamia, from Egypt, and apply them too widely, assuming that state formation, the development of civilization, worked everywhere in the world as it did in these cases. And if we do this uncritically, then we may obscure or miss important variation in the ways in which states developed in other parts of the world. So we're now going to turn our attention to other regions, exploring both other models of early state functioning, because in fact, as we'll see, the Egyptian and Mesopotamian models are not the only way of thinking about the origins of ancient states and civilization. And also, we're going to explore other topics of interest to archaeologists. For example, the collapse of ancient state systems, a topic that certainly is widely recognized, particularly among the general public, as a significant and interesting issue, the ways in which ancient civilizations not merely expand but collapse. And also an interesting idea that among archaeologists, the idea of cycling between different levels of political centralization, the idea that we may go in a continuous fashion from relatively decentralized political systems towards states, which are far more centralized, but then move back to less centralized, less hierarchical political structures. And actually, the case that I want to talk about today may be an excellent example of just this kind of cycling of political systems taking place in the archaeological record. The habits of statehood spread relatively quickly from Mesopotamia and the Nile Valley in the 3rd millennium BC. The Levant, this country behind the eastern shores of the Mediterranean, exists between these two early centers of state formation. And it would have been exposed to these habits of civilization very quickly indeed. But it also seems to have acted at times as a frontier zone, one of the frontier zones that I was talking about last time, on the edges of the territories of these more powerful states. This, of course, is not always a very comfortable place to be. When I was talking about Egypt and the extent, the reach of the Egyptian state, I talked, for example, about Ramses II and the Battle of Kadesh between the Egyptian and Hittite empires. Kadesh was in Syria, and a little bit to the north, but generally in the same zone as the areas that I'm going to talk about today. As far as we know, the first farmers in the world lived in the Levant, in this area, in what's now Israel and Palestine, Jordan, Lebanon, and Syria, more than 10,000 years ago. In broad terms, the cultural history of this region is thus more analogous to that of northern Mesopotamia than to the Nile Valley, at least until perhaps 4000 BC. By that time, 4000 BC, farmers of a tradition called the Gesulian culture occupied this area behind the eastern shores of the Mediterranean, in Israel and Jordan, in the area that we call the southern Levant. The Gesulian culture is a very interesting one, known from a variety of different sites. One of the things that I find most interesting about the Gesulian is that we have on a number of sites, but particularly at the type site, Tulalat el-Gasul, we have evidence for extraordinarily beautiful artwork on some walls that were left relatively intact on the site. And just as an illustration of the things that have disappeared, the things that archaeologists, we always hope we get to see, but so often we don't. The Gesulian tradition generally corresponds to the roughly contemporary Amratian culture in Upper Egypt and to the Halathian and Sumerian cultures of roughly 1,000 years earlier in Mesopotamia. Gesulian communities and related farming groups from the northern Negev to southern Lebanon practiced a broad-based agricultural system with a focus on the cultivation of that standard suite of West Asian cereal crops, wheat and barley. Talked about them before. Some members of those communities, or people attached to those communities in some ways, also seem to have been at least semi-nomadic pastoralists, grazing herds of cattle, sheep, and goats in different areas, unproductive for farming. I've talked in earlier lectures as well about these kind of relationships between farmers on the one hand and pastoralists on the other, particularly in Mesopotamia. But in fact, as I said, this is a relationship, an important economic and social relationship in many parts of the world. In the Levant case, it's not clear how these two different components of the economy, farming and pastoralism, articulated for Gesulian communities, nor whether pastoralists would have thought of themselves as belonging to the same ethnic group as the farmers. And again, if you'll remember, in the Mesopotamian case, this was an issue. Are they members of a single ethnic group or of different ethnic groups? By about 4000 BC, then, there's also botanical evidence for the introduction of simple forms of irrigation and of fruit growing, especially of olives and dates, to the Levant, which helped make possible increases in the size of sedentary communities. And it's interesting because it's at this point that we can see the beginnings of a sophisticated and productive agricultural system that would, in one way or another, sustain this region for most of the next 6,000 years. Indeed, into the modern period, that it's really at 4000 BC that we begin to see on the eastern shores of the Mediterranean farming systems that look quite a bit like those in the historical period, in the 17th, 18th, 19th centuries. I can't emphasize the importance of this too much. It would make possible what comes later in this region in general, but perhaps, as we're going to see, it may also carry within it this sophisticated agricultural system with its different components of farming and pastoralism, may carry within it the seeds of a kind of cycling between different social and political structures, because these systems pastoralism and farming can either be complementary or they can be alternatives to one another. What else do we know about the Gesulian after 4000 BC? Well, craft production, especially of copper artifacts, but also stone sculpture, prestige ceramics, seems to have expanded considerably in the period between about 4000 and 3500 BC. In regional archaeological chronologies, this period is known as the Late Chalcolithic, or Copper Age. Why copper? Copper is relatively easy to smelt and to form into artifacts. But in its pure form, it's also very soft. It doesn't make good utilitarian tools. No one's going to, very successfully anyway, make hoes or axes out of copper and expect them to be particularly useful purely as utilitarian artifacts. Copper is also relatively rare compared to a lot of other metals like iron. What this means is that this metal, copper, as used in the Chalcolithic, tends to be used for prestige and ceremonial items, not utilitarian tools. And that's important, because what it does is it gives populations, and particularly the developing elites in Gesulian and related populations, a way of representing their status, a rare and relatively useless material that's valuable, can be formed into beautiful shapes. What better as a signal of elite status? At the same time, the political environment of this part of the Levant became more complicated after 4000 BC. These larger settlements, like Tulalat el Gasul itself, the type site for the Gesulian, Gilat and Shikmim, each during this period had populations that probably numbered in the low thousands. And they appear to have existed as the top rank in a two-tiered settlement hierarchy. I've talked about the importance of these settlement hierarchies before. There's increased evidence for complex shrines and cemeteries in different parts of the area during this period as well. Come back to these shrines and cemeteries in a moment because they are potentially extremely important. Archaeologists identify this period as one in which small chiefdoms developed in this part of the Near East, in the Levant. So again, we have this term chiefdom. And I have to ask again, is that all there is to a chiefdom? Those cases where archaeologists aren't yet certain they have states? Because it appears to be, as we've seen and as we will continue to see, a sort of a default term for those ancient societies where archaeologists are a little bit unsure about the level of political centralization. This Gesulian culture in its developed form, expanding through the period between about 4000 and 3500 BC, this system seems to have broken down at about 3500 BC, which is the period that marks the beginning of the regional Bronze Age. We've got a shift now in the way that we designate the period again based on the appearance of a new metal, bronze, an alloy of copper and tin. And as we'll see through time, through these lectures, a significantly more useful material in a variety of different ways. About 3500 BC, in this region, these large communities are abandoned. And the population of the area appears, for some centuries, to either decline and or perhaps to shift to very mobile settlement patterns that are not easily detectable by archaeologists. This may imply a shift of emphasis from farming to pastoralism during this period. And again, in earlier lectures, I talked about how difficult it is for archaeologists to detect traces of pastoralism in the record. Pastoralists tend to be mobile. They don't tend to leave permanent traces of their encampments and habitations. And so a disappearance of population, or what looks like a relative disappearance of population, after 3500 BC, may in fact be a shift toward a different way of life. Can we then talk about this period, around 3500 BC and afterwards, as the collapse of a political and social system that until that point had seemed to be developing generally according to those cultural trajectories that we've been looking at in other parts of the world? You wanted to talk about the Gesulian as the equivalent of perhaps Sumerian or Ubaid Mesopotamia, developing towards ever larger political and social structures? Then there's an interruption at 3500 BC. Is this a collapse? How should we think about it? Thomas Levy, an archaeologist working in this area, has developed a model that may help to explain these processes, and I think it's a very useful model. In this model, growing populations in the late 5th millennium BC required changes in farming technologies that we've seen, especially, as I noted, with the introduction of irrigation and fruit growing, as well as much more intensive use of animal products than was the case in earlier times. This was also a period of increasing craft specialization and also of expansion of trade routes to Egypt, to Uruk, Mesopotamia, and probably across the eastern Mediterranean as well. And we have excellent examples of these trade routes running through this region. Think about where this area in the eastern Mediterranean coast, the Levant, is. We're talking here about a real crossroads between Mesopotamia, the islands of the eastern Mediterranean, Egypt, southern Anatolia, in what's now Turkey. It may be an uncomfortable place to live when it's being invaded, but there are also all kinds of opportunities there as well. So this economic and political activity between 4000 and 3500 BC, according to Tom Levy's model then, also involved increased territoriality and competition between leaders in different communities, and thus the use of formal cemeteries and public sanctuaries to make claims over space in ideologically supported ways. Ancestral occupation over the land is invoked, over the land that a particular community or lineage claims for itself, through, for example, a cemetery, while a sanctuary is an even more public assertion of control. There are all kinds of ways in which cemeteries make these kinds of claims for us about how the world works. When I was talking about Çatalhöyük, I described the occupation of this ancient Neolithic site, Çatalhöyük, in Anatolia. One of the things I noted at Çatalhöyük is that it seems that people are memorializing claims of control through relations back to their ancestors. And in fact, in many ways, this is something that we still do in different parts of the world. If one goes to Washington, for example, one of the real points of pilgrimage for Americans is Arlington. Where I work in Central Africa, the community that I did my own dissertation in has at its very center the community cemetery what's known in the Plechla language of those people as Thadi Dumlalai. The lineage name is Dumlalai, and the literal translation is, this is the heart of Dumlalai, because this is where the ancestors continue to live. We belong to this place. We have rights, we have privileges in this place, because this is where our ancestors were, and this is where they continue to be. It's a powerful way of claiming both history and land. So we have then increases in scale. We have competition between communities. Elites in communities laying claims to land, to territory. You can see some of the themes that, for example, I talked about last time. Control over land. Competition between these communities then. How can this be managed? Because you have to have some way of managing competition, or you may well end up in a spiral of violence that can't be controlled. So how do you mediate competition? Well, according to Levy's model, through the use of a number of different techniques. For example, the development of formal accords, formal treaties between different groups, possibly sanctioned ritually and publicly at important shrines. Competition for valuable material resources. These could involve things like, for example, copper deposits. Through warfare, in some cases, certainly. And perhaps, quite likely actually, competitive gift-giving between elites. Competitive gift-giving. Again, this latter seems strange to us, but in fact, it's a very common and widely spread way for elites to compete in different parts of the world. I show a film to my students at Bowdoin, a wonderful film about a New Guinea society, a group of people called the Kwelka. The film is called Anka's Big Mocha, and a mocha in this case not being a drink, but rather a ceremony in which big men in this Kwelka society overawe and humiliate their rivals by giving things away to them, particularly pigs, which are the basis of Kwelka political and economic and ideological systems, and literally gain status and humble their rivals by giving things to those rivals that those rivals cannot reciprocate. So to sum up this model then, Levy's model, it talks about the relationships between population growth and technological and economic intensification and how elites responded to that. Levy makes a good case that at least some of these factors are visible in the archaeological record of this part of the southern Levant. According to this model, the collapse of this intensifying political system took place at about 3500 BC, and that came about for a variety of different reasons, probably happening in combination. And these included climate change, the subsequent breakdown of these complex and intensive and, I must say, delicate sociocultural systems, the breakdown of long-distance exchange and trading networks, possibly associated with warfare, likely with Egyptian pre-dynastic forces. So, it's a useful model, an interesting model, and there's some good data that support it, I think. However, what we need to remember here is because these different components of this economic system, intensive agriculture and efficient pastoralism, remained in place, there also remains the potential for further periods of population growth and urbanism. So you can see where the cycling comes in here. And in many ways, This seems to be what the archaeological record of this region indicates, up until much more recent times. Repeated cycles of growth and dissolution of more complex, larger scale, more centralized, more urban political and cultural systems. So Bronze Age history, for example, in this area, continues to be characterized by this complex series of oscillations between times of political centralization and urbanism, and times of much more dispersed and mobile settlement and political fragmentation. I think these models are generally much more realistic than earlier ones that located cycles of urbanism in the Levant only in the varying influence of from at different times Egypt and Mesopotamia, as if people in this region were always passive recipients of other people's innovations. To give you examples of the time periods and that are processes that I'm talking about, the period that's known as the Early Bronze Age II in the system, in the nomenclature of archaeologists working in this region, EB2, dates from about 3100 to 2700 BC. And the Early Bronze II period was, again, a period of substantial settlement growth, with the first regional, real urban centers appearing at places many of which we may have heard of before: Jericho, Megiddo, Arad, and Yarmouth, with populations in the low thousands each. The Early Bronze IV period, the succeeding period between 2350 and 2000 BC, on the other hand, was essentially non-urban. We're going to see similar series of oscillations between political centralization and political dispersal in other parts of the world as well. Each of those early Bronze II settlements, the larger urban settlements that I talked about before 2300 BC, sat at the apex of a three-tier settlement hierarchy of the sort that I mentioned when speaking about Sumer in Mesopotamia. Larger centers, each surrounded by smaller villages, each of which was in turn surrounded by rural hamlets. These early Bronze II settlements display abundant evidence for a lot of political and social hierarchy, really quite developed political and social hierarchy. They would probably represent small, independent, and highly competitive states. Smaller, but more akin to the city-states of Mesopotamia than to the Egyptian early dynastic territorial state. After 2000 BC, in the period known as the Middle Bronze Age, Canaanite Hazor, in what is now Israel, was probably the dominant urban center in this part of the Levant. It was a substantial town, or perhaps we can say city, approximately 200 acres in size, perhaps with a population of 20,000 people, and thus comparable to Egyptian urban centers of the same time. It also controlled areas around it, out to probably 50 kilometers, 30 miles at least. And it seems during this period that the people of the Levant had really absorbed the principles of urban life in a way equal to those of any other populations around them. The southern Levant was increasingly coming under Egyptian influence at this time, and complex relations existed between Hazor and the Egyptian state, which was trying to reduce it to vassalage. But I don't think we can see the developments at places like Hazor as in any way borrowings from Egypt. They appear to have an internal local dynamic of their own. Levy's model may quite likely be relevant to later periods in the Levant as well. Of course, we have to remember that through the Bronze Age, the region was also subject to intense interactions, both peaceful and violent, with neighboring and more powerful states, especially Egypt. For my next lecture, I want to again shift our attention offshore in this case, to examine the ways in which complex political systems developed on the islands and along the coastlines of the Eastern Mediterranean to culminate in one of the most interesting civilizations that we will look at during this set of lectures, that of the Minoans and Mycenaeans. Thank you.